I do. I even post it online every week, including this one. Okay. This week's topic, we are officially in Chodesh Kislev. We're a week into Chodesh Kislev, not just Stam. Is the topic of Hiddur Mitzvah. It's something that's almost inseparable from the holiday of Hanukkah. You have source sheets? Good. Because the mitzvah itself, as we'll see already immediately in the very few sources that exist, primary sources that exist about Hanukkah being the last canonized holiday that has been established by the entirety of the Jewish people as an official holiday. It's the latest holiday. Some people confuse Purim and Hanukkah, since Purim happens later in the calendar year than Hanukkah, and then it happened, but it actually happened earlier in history, Hanukkah being in the middle of the Second Temple period, towards the end, whereas Purim was right after the 70 years after the First Temple was destroyed. So, we need to discuss Hiddur Mitzvah, and we'll see why we need to discuss it. It's a nice thing, it's a beautiful thing. What's the problem? Why are we? What's there any confusion about? But we'll see that there's some irregular activity here regarding Hanukkah and Hiddur Mitzvah. We do see that Hiddur Mitzvah exists in many other places. Does anyone know of another place where Hiddur Mitzvah exists? Hiddur Mitzvah, sorry, I should define what Hiddur Mitzvah is. Hiddur Mitzvah means taking a normal, regular mitzvah and glorifying or beautifying it, making it bigger or nicer or better than what is the minimum requirement of the mitzvah. So it's doing something and adding to it in some way, not necessarily doing two of it, but adding to that one thing to make it a nicer, more beautiful mitzvah. Do we have that? So it really can exist in almost every mitzvah, meaning there are nicer pairs of tefillin. If it's a little bigger, if actually the truth is the more hitter regarding tefillin is the actual writing of the on the parchment, there are nicer ways of writing it and worse, and so too by Sefer Torah and Mezuzah. You mentioned one that is very well known, which is etrog, lulav and etrog, right? There's quite minimal requirements, in truth, to have a kosher lulav and etrog. And yet, you see people, especially if you go over the bridge, which is where I got mine, man, do they go all out in making sure it's perfect and beautiful, and they get it checked by three different people, and it's funny, because I had there was a rabbi that taught in the yeshiva that I went to in Israel called Shaul Vim, and he's a Holocaust survivor, he's very Zionistic, he's just one of these very classic, his name is Moshe Gantz. And it was known that if you brought your lulav and etrog for him to check to see if it was kosher or not, he would tell you everyone is kosher, because he couldn't say anything bad about a fruit or something that came from Eretz Yisrael. And he was right, because pretty much everything that came his way was kosher. But there's the concept of making it beautiful, making it as nice as possible. And the source for this is, by the way, in Sefer Shmos, the pasuk, or the phrase, Zeh Keli Ve'anveihu, this is my God, and I will glorify him. What does that mean? That doesn't just mean that I will just follow his commandments, but it means I will make it beautiful, nicer, better than just the status quo or the minimum requirement. And let's see in source number one, the most primary source for the holiday of Hanukkah found in the Gemara Maseches Shabbos, Chafal from the Beis, the second parak of Shabbos. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis teach, the very first source. Mitzvahs ner Hanukkah, ner Yishu Beso. If you ask a rabbi, what is the mitzvah of lighting candles on Hanukkah? One candle for the entire family. Doesn't matter which night, doesn't matter if you have 18 kids or one kid or no kids, one candle each night. Which means how many total candles do you light over the 8 days of Hanukkah?
Eight.
That already fulfills the requirement of lighting candles on Hanukkah. Many people actually don't know this. They don't know that that's the minimum, that's fulfilling the mitzvah, because it's very rarely done this way. Why? Because the Gemara continues. The Hamahadrin, and if you want to do it even better, oh, the one day that I get like the exact amount of source sheets, because I think people I have like 40 other source sheets from previous weeks if you want. Thank you for coming, everyone. I'll know for next time. The Hamahadrin, and if you want to do the mitzvah better, if you want to make it nicer than the minimum requirement, Ner l'chol echad v'echad. So you light one candle each night, regardless of which night of Hanukkah it is, one candle per person in the household. So if you have five people in your house, you would light five candles each night of Hanukkah, which would be 40 total candles, five each night. Now, it doesn't necessarily clearly state in the Gemara who's lighting five. It seems to be that it would still be the head of the household lighting five, corresponding to the people in his family, and not that each person in the family would light one, which would total five, just to point that out. And there is a machlokas over this, there's an argument over this, so this is not coming from nowhere. And then the Gemara continues, V'amahadrin, min amahadrin. And if you want to be really awesome, if you want to just go all out on this mitzvah, which is probably the one we're most familiar with, the version of this mitzvah we're most familiar with, there's an argument. Beis Shammai Omrim, the Talmidim of Beis Shammai say, Yom Rishon Madlik Shmona, on the first night you light eight candles, which is in the singular, seeming to refer to the head of the household, Mikan, although that's debated, Mikan ve'elech poches v'holech, and each night of Hanukkah, after the first one, it goes down in numbers. So the first night of Hanukkah, you light eight. Second night you light seven. Third, you light six. Interesting. Not what we're used to. Why? Because we follow Beis Hillel. The Talmidim of Hillel, Omrim, they say, Yom Rishon Madlik Echas, the first night, or Achat, the first night you light one candle, Mikan Ve'elech Mosev Holech, and from there on, you add another candle, which means it would be one, and then two, and then three, up until the eighth night when you light eight. Amar Ula, fine. We'll leave it at that for now. So, first of all, the regular mitzvah, there's no argument. The Mahadrin mitzvah, there's no argument. And then there's a third level of Mahadrin, which there's even a discussion over how to do it the best, as if there's only one way to do it the best way. This is a weird thing, and I mean, I didn't look through all of the Torah yet, unfortunately, I haven't gotten there, but in the travels that I've gone, in the Sea of the Talmud, as they say, this is not found. There are discussions over what a nicer etrog is, but it's really just the fewer blemishes it has, then the nicer it is, by definition. There's no, like, fourth-tier Mahadrin for an etrog. It's just nicer or less nice. Here, there's documented levels of beauty, of awesome, for the Neros Hanukkah, and this is a strange and unique thing. And why is this so? And why would it be so that, why would it be discussed enough that there would be an argument over what the best way to do it is? And again, each of these things can have an entire shiur. I know I say that a lot. But it's a very fascinating topic, and I just want to discuss why it's so connected to this mitzvah, Hiddur mitzvah. As I mentioned in the beginning, practically no one knows that the basic mitzvah of Neros Chanukah is light one candle per house each night. We are very familiar with Beis Hillel, which is one candle per person, and add it each night, add another candle each night.
But isn't the argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel not whether it's better, or it's there, that's the only opinion of that you do more than one candle every night, right? The Mahadrin Minahadrin.
The Mahadrin version is that each household lights according to the amount of people in the house.
Right.
But it stays that way each night.
But the argument of Beis Shammai is not whether it's better, it's whether you count up or count down. It's not
right, but Beis Shammai would say if you're counting up, you're not doing it the best way, right? Because the best way is counting down, according
to
Beis Shammai.
It's a question of how you light in general. It's not a question of...
But what would Beis Shammai say if you said, I'm going to light up? Well, that's not the best way to do it. Well, that by definition, that means that you haven't done it the best way. Right? Fine. There is a machlokes. There is an argument in the Rishonim, the commentaries of the Talmud, regarding the argument that takes place regarding Mahadrin, Minamahadrin, the highest form of this mitzvah, the most beautiful form. Tosvos says the following thing. He makes a very important observation. Nira Liri, it seems to the Ri, was one of the Balitosos, one of the Rishonim, the Beis Shammai Beis Hillel, lo kaimi ela aner ishu beiso. He is answering an implied question, which is, when you talk about Mahadrin min Mahadrin, which is that you light one candle and corresponding to each night you add another one or take away another one, is that Mahadrin min Mahadrin going on, it's adding to the level two, or is it adding to the level one? If you remember, level one, only the head of the household lights. Level two, he lights for each of the family members. Now, is level three adding to level two, which means each of the family members adds a candle each night, and therefore the head of the household would be lighting five on the first night and 10 on the second night, right, and 15 on the third night, or is it just the head of the household lighting one menorah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? It's a good question. Now, the Tosvot answer, it seems, according to the read, that it's only going on the level one, the basic mitzvah, which means only the head of the household would be lighting in this tier three, Mahadrin min Mahadrin way. Shekin yesh yoter hidur, because it's a bigger hidur to do it this way. The ika hekera kishemosif v'holech, O mechsar shehu keneged yamin achnasim o yotzim. See, the hidur, he says, is connected to the people in public who are looking at your menorah, recognizing what night or what's going on in the situation. Now, this is a very interesting thing. This isn't as relevant nowadays when most people have a menorah, and even if you have the most basic one, it's clear that there is an individual menorah. For many years, they would simply put candles on a table or little bowls. So if there was five people on the second night of Hanukkah in your household, and you were doing Mahadrin min Mahadrin, I'm just going to try and get this right, I get this wrong every time I think about this. You're doing Mahadrin min Mahadrin, so there would just be 10 candles out there, right? The second night of Hanukkah, five people in your household. Let's say it's only the head of the household lights, so there would be 10 candles out there. Now, 10 candles could also mean that it's the fifth night of Hanukkah and there are two people in your household, right? And therefore, the best way to do Mahadrin min Mahadrin is to keep it at one person lighting one menorah. Because if you get stuck with your family members, people will just look at lights like, that doesn't mean anything to me. What does it mean that there are 17 lights out there? Is it the fourth night? There's seven kids? What's going on? So let's just keep it at one person. And that, according to the Ri in Tosvot, is the maximum level of Hiddur because of the clarity that it offers to the passers-by of what is going on in that window. Yes?
Is that really a question?
What do you mean, is that really a question?
The Jews who supposedly celebrate Hanukkah aren't going to know if you put 17, what's going on here? The people who don't know what's going on are going to say 17 and be like, I don't know what's going on. What are they going to say?
Well,
also involved in that.
Right, so...
You say person on Anissa, you're supposed to know what's...
So Perry is pointing out, and Tosfot is implying that we're already familiar with the idea that the mitzvah of Hanukkah, it's actually later in the Gemara we didn't talk about, where you should do it. It's the second paragraph of source number one, where you should put the menorah. And the location of the menorah is for the reason of Pirsume Nisa. I actually gave a shiur on Pirsume Nisa last year. Pirsume Nisa is publicizing the miracle. And again, intimately connected with the mitzvah of Neros Chanukah is not only the hiddur part, but also the fact that it don't mean anything unless other people, including, by the way, possibly your own family members, are seeing it and understanding it and appreciating it for what it is. Otherwise, it's unnecessary what we're doing. That's a whole other shiur. I'll post it online if you want to see it. Maybe I really will, so you could listen to that. But that seems to be a part of the hiddur, meaning the hiddur of the mitzvah, the beautification of the mitzvah, is building on the basic mitzvah. What is the basic mitzvah connected to? The publicizing of the miracle. And if the publicizing of the miracle is not clear, because why are there a bunch of lights over there? Even that slight confusion, even though it's very clear that it's Hanukkah, and it's very clear that it's one of the nights of Hanukkah, and there's a couple of family members in there, but I didn't figure it out. Why is that going to matter? Why is that going to take away? It's not the best. And that's what Tosfot is trying to say. The best is when it's crystal clear and it's perfect and it's great and you can't ask any questions on it. That's what he's saying. Now the Rambam, Maimonides, argues on this point, and he takes the other side, which is that the level 3, the Mahadran and Mahadran, is actually building off of the level 2, as opposed to the level 1. What does he say in source number 3? Kama neiros u madlik b'chanaka. Mitzvasa sheyeh kol bayis v'bayis madlik ner echad. Bein sheyu an sheyeh bayis meruba bein sheloyu ela adam echad. That's the regular basic mitzvah. V'hamahader es a mitzvah, level 2, madlik neiros k'minyan an sheyeh bayis, right? If it's a 5-person family, you light 5 each night. And if you want to even get better than that, and you want to do it the best possible way, you light the candle for each person in your household, clearly building off of level 2. Balayla harishon, you light one. So he is taking the other side and saying, if there are 5 people in your house, on the first night, you light 5, and on the second night, you light 10. Now, he still, by the way, is talking about the head of the household. So, Svardim, often only the head of the household, lights for each family. The truth is, sorry, I messed that up. Svardim do that because they hold, like, Tosfot, which is one of the only times in, really, all of Halacha, that the Svardic law follows Tosfot, which were heavily Ashkenazic Poskim, and the Ashkenazic law follows the Rambam, which was absolutely Sephardic. And we see that in source number 4. Shulchan Aruch says, Hilchos Chanukah, Kama Neiros Madlik, so he says, he doesn't even get to the, by the way, this is an important observation. Shulchan Aruch does not even discuss what the basic mitzvah is. He says, what should you do? If you're asking me what to do, this is what you should do. On the first night, you light one candle, mikan ve'elech, and subsequently, mosif v'holech, echad b'chol layla, you add one each night, ad shevelelachar n'yushmona. And this is all in singular form. He's talking about the head of the household, which is corresponding to the ruling of Tosfot. V'afilu im rabin b'nei abayis lo yadliku yoter. Don't do more just because you want to do it better. This is the best way to do it. One menorah in each house. And then the Rama, who is the Ashkenazic halachic authority, adds, V'yesh omrim dekol echad mi b'nei habayis yadlik. And if you see the parentheses, this is the Rambam. That the Rama holds like the Rambam. V'chein ha-minhag pashut. Now, the Rama adds something. He changes it a little bit. This is just public service announcement. He says that each person in the household should light. That's not what the Rambam said. The Rambam said that you should the head of the household should light corresponding to each of the households. So he changes it, which is why people say, no, really, the Sfarda custom still follows the Rambam. Don't think that all of a sudden we switch it up on you. And really, the Rama kind of used the Rambam and then came up with his own thing for the Ashkenazi custom, which is what we follow today, which is every single person lights a menorah. And he says 3 words that I should have underlined. V'chein ha-minhag pashut. In modern language, I would say, this is straight up what we do. Which is funny, because if you were following along, this is not straight up what we do. This is the absolute best. You can't do it better, and there are like 3.5 other levels lower than that that you can do, and totally be fine, except the Rama doesn't even acknowledge that, nor does the Shulchan Aruch. He simply says, do it this way, and don't ask what other ways there are to do it. And you should put them in separate places. And the reason why he's saying that is to avoid Tosos's problem, which is how many people in this house, how many nights in this house. If you make sure that each member of the family is separate from the other members of the family's candles, you won't run into that problem. So you still maintain the highest level of hiddur. Very good point that he makes. Kadesha ye heker kama neiros madlikim. The question is, that we have to ask, do you see this anywhere else? Where not only are there several levels of doing it better, not only is it documented that there are specific guidelines for how to do it better, as opposed to you liking it better, which, by the way, the main mitzvah of beautifying the lulav and esrog is not if other people think it's better, it's if you like it better. And if you'll notice, by an etrog, there are lots of different kinds. There's big, small, there's green, there's really, really yellow, there's like the green but turning yellow, kind of, with like the greenish dots. There's the pointy, there's the big round circle, and different people like different kinds. By the way, I have a whole theory about if you could figure out what dating, yeah, what who a person should date based on their etrog. But it's another time. I already gave a dating shiur, but we'll talk maybe next year. It's a personal thing. Is this beautiful for me? Is this the most beautiful etrog for me? If it is, then that's the most beautiful way of me doing this mitzvah. Here, it's not. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter if you think it's more beautiful to go, you know, downwards each day as opposed to up. This is the way to do it, says the Rama. That's strange. And not only is that strange, but the Rama doesn't see any other alternative. You don't do it less than Mahadran Min HaMahadran. And that, if you think about it, undermines the whole idea of beautifying a mitzvah. Because if he's saying that this is the basic way to do it, then it's not the most beautiful way to do it. It's just the way to do it. And why can't I do it differently and better and nicer? It takes away from the whole point of making it more beautiful for you if everyone's doing it this way, or if I'm only really supposed to do it this way and not better and not worse. Not only that, but we see, it's originally in the Rambam and it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, it's actually the halacha right before the one that we discussed, it's source number 5. That we should, he says, Tzarech Lizar Mehod Bahadlakas Meod Bahadlakas Neros Chanukah. You should be very vigilant, very careful to make sure to light the Neros Chanukah, the Chanukah candles. Vafilu Ani Hamisparnis Benetzdaka. And even if you're poor and you don't have any income, and you're literally the only money you have is through charity, Shoel O Mocher Ksuso Velokeach Shemen Lahadlik. You should borrow money or even sell the shirt on your back. I'm quoting the Shulchan Aruch on this, and you should purchase oil to light. Now think about this. On its own, that's a crazy thing to say, because the truth is there are guidelines for how much money you are halakhically permitted to spend on a mitzvah, and there's actually a limit. It's up to a third of the money that you have. And you can't spend any more. Now, this totally violates that, because this is saying if you have $0, you have to spend money, which you don't even have. So that's more than 100% of the money that you have. You have to spend on Neros Chanukah. And keep in mind, this isn't even a biblical holiday, a biblical mitzvah. This is the most recent mitzvah that was ever mandated by the Jewish rabbinic authorities. And yet, we have to go to the craziest extreme to light, and again, combine this with the previous halacha, which says the only way to do this mitzvah is the absolute best, so you're not even supposed to just sell the shirt on your back to light one candle each night. You're supposed to sell the shirt on your back to do it the best way possible, to skip the one candle, to do the 10 candles. That seems really out of place. It doesn't seem to be consistent with Jewish law, definitely not with other places where we bring in the idea of Mahadran. There are plenty of places where there's the idea of Lechachila and Bidi'eved, which means to do it the ideal best way, and then to still get, you know, checked off for doing the mitzvah, even if you do it in a plan B type of way. And here, we're not even giving room for the plan B. And this is the only place where the Gemara actually talks about how there's a plan A, B, and C. So to begin to try and answer this question, I think it's first important to understand what the lighting of the candles on Chanukah are supposed to represent or are based off of. And there are two very well-known ideas based on the story of Chanukah that we know, but the details of those stories are what make this important and what will lead us, hopefully, to this answer. The Gemara, which I won't read inside, back in source number 1, very famously, the third paragraph of that says, "My Chanukah." What Chanukah? If I translate it literally. What Chanukah? Question mark. which, as Rashi points out, is what is the miracle that Hanukkah was established to commemorate? Which miracle, actually? Because there were two, and the funny thing is that the Gemara only mentions really one. Well, it kind of mentions two, but it focuses on one. But there were two. What were the two miracles? Pach Shemen and the war. Pach Shemen being what, more specifically?
8 days instead of 1.
They had a shortage of olive oil. What kind of olive oil? Shemen Zayit Zach, which is the pure olive oil, which, by the way, just to know practically, it was the first drop out of the olive. And they had to collect all of those and put it in a bottle. That is called the pure olive oil. And it had to be sealed with the bottle had to be sealed shut, and the Kohen Gadol seal had to be stamped on top of it to prove that this was untainted and completely pure olive oil. And that's the oil that was used for the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. And when they came back to reestablish the service in the Beit HaMikdash after they defeated the Greeks, they only found one remaining bottle whose seal was unbroken. And they said, you know what, we'll light it for one night, and that's all we got anyways. And a miracle occurred, and that one night's worth of oil lasted for 8 nights. And there's actually 100 different interpretations of how exactly that oil lasted for 8 nights, but we'll, for another time. What's the other miracle? The war. What was the war? What? Who are they fighting? Who are they fighting?
Greeks.
Right, and who was fighting them? Right, a family, the Chashmonaim. It was a family. It wasn't an army. It wasn't a community or a city. It was like the Goldbergs down the block. They decided to fight the Greek army. They said, we're not going to take it anymore. I don't know why we're doing this. Someone convinced me not to do this, but let's go. And they won. Now, if you hear that come out of my mouth, it's almost silly sounding, because of how crazy it is that they decided to fight the Greek army. And then it's crazier when you realize that they won. And what's interesting is that most of the focus of the holiday is turned to the oil miracle, but really that war thing was unbelievable. It was out of this world crazy. People talk about the Six-Day War in 1967 here, about how every single surrounding nation collapsed on Israel in one day, and wars that often can take months or years, this one was supposed to be over because the Israelis should have been completely annihilated in a matter of days, and in 6 days' time, which never happens. Remember, Operation Cast Lead and Protective Edge, which just happened, took longer than that, took a couple months and a couple weeks. In 6 days, we beat every single enemy. That was an open miracle, and anyone who was there, who was a part of it, who was alive at the time, will tell you there was no way of explaining it militarily any other way. This was that times 157,000. That's what it was. There was no, you know, superpowers. It wasn't like Hashmonaim, like, turned into the Hulk. It wasn't like that. But they won, and you can't understand how they won, because it was a miracle. Now, here's the thing about these two different miracles. They have one common denominator. It was an instance where Jews weren't satisfied with the status quo, with the basic, with the everything's okay. They needed things to be good. Not just good, they needed things to be great. The best possible situation, spiritually. Regarding the oil, there's a famous halacha. Three words in Hebrew, tuma, actually in Aramaic, hutra bitzibura. When it comes to matters of the entire nation or the community of Jewish people, you are allowed to use something that is spiritually impure in order to fulfill a mitzvah. So in the case of lighting a menorah, which is a mitzvah that is on the entire nation of the Jewish people, it's not any individual's mitzvah to light a menorah, you could use not just less than the highest pure form of oil, but you could even use impure oil to light the menorah, and it would have been totally halachically acceptable. There would have been no problems. Every single rabbi on earth at the time would have said, you're totally good. No worries. Except Right then, the Jewish people said, we're not going to light our menorah just the basic way that you can. Even if the rabbis say it's okay, we want to do it the best way. Understand now, the miracle didn't need to happen. They could have just used the other oil that the seal was broken, and it would have been halakhically fine. The menorah would have lit just fine. There was probably hundreds of bottles of oil there, or surrounding them, and they said, uh-oh, we've run out of oil. Why? Because they said, we're not lighting this menorah unless we're doing it the right way, the best way. The most pure form of olive oil is the only oil we're going to use, and God saw that and performed a miracle for them based off of that. The war. Again, the war gets overlooked a lot. Who started this war? Exactly. It's not so clear. Who started this war? Hashmonaim. Any other answer? I mean, there's only one other possible answer. The Greeks. Anyone think it's the Greeks? Okay, good. You're all right. The Greeks didn't start a war. They were totally fine. Now, there was a great deal of oppression, but it wasn't even physical oppression. It was spiritual oppression. They didn't want us to keep a few mitzvos, a few specific ones. They didn't like us learning Torah, which is the whole story of the dreidel. They didn't want us to be doing the things that we love doing as Jews, but we were fine. No one was hurting us. No one was killing us. There was no war. There was no famine. There was no starvation. There was no torture. And one family said, I don't want to live a plan B life anymore as a Jew. I want to live the best possible life as a Jew. And I'm not going to just sit here and let them decide that I have to just live this Bidi Eved lifestyle. So they took whatever weapons they had in their house and they said, we're going to fight. And understand that when you're in their position, fighting a Greek army as a family, you don't survive. You don't go into that war saying you'll survive. You know what? Maybe we could pull this one off. This was not a thought that went into their heads, I imagine, at least if they were sane. Which means that they were walking into that war saying, our lives are not meaningful enough to be lived this way. It's not okay that we're going to continue to live like this without putting up a fight. And I don't care if that fight is completely unfair. And I don't care if that immediately spells our death. It's more worth it for us to give our lives for the statement that we're making that living as a Jew means certain things. And it doesn't mean that other people get to decide what we can do and what we can't do. And it was that idea that the miracle was born. The miracle of winning that war was born. It wasn't that their backs were against the wall and they were about to be all killed and they were surrounded and God somehow protected them. No. These people walked into a death sentence. But the death sentence was, we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to take half Jewish. We're not going to do it. We want all Jewish or nothing. And that's the miracle. Now, that's the beginning of understanding how Chazal, how the rabbis went about commemorating that mitzvah. Because, you see, if you just light candles, then you might, and it could be that many people do, hopefully we don't anymore forever, you might overlook this detail. It's not just that God performed the miracle when we needed it. Uh-oh, we wouldn't be able to perform the mitzvah of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, so God performed the miracle. No, we could have done the mitzvah of the in the Beit HaMikdash just fine. And God didn't need to perform any miracles. We would have overlooked that. And the only reason the miracle came is because we wanted to do it the best possible way. And why did we do it? Because we just won a war that we started ourselves because we wanted to live the best possible form of Jewish life. And that's what we're commemorating. We're not just commemorating the mitzvah, the miracle. We're commemorating what brought about that miracle, which was our feelings of doing, of living a Jewish life the right way. A passionate, real Jewish life where we don't settle for anything less than perfect. This idea is mentioned all over the place in commentaries. And I just brought a few to point it out. The Sfas Emes in source number 7. I skipped 6 for now. Discusses how there was this war between the Greeks and the Jews was very existed on many different levels. It was an ideological war. Even though it ended up being a physical military war, it was a war based on ideas. It was the culture of the Greeks versus the culture of the Jews. And he basically says, I'm not going to read it inside. You can read it inside yourself. That the idea of Greek culture was celebrating and glorifying nature. They were philosophers. They dealt with logic. They dealt with beauty, materialism. They were very good sculptors. They were great building buildings. They glorified the human body. It was all having to do with nature. Anything beyond nature was not part of their lifestyle, was not part of their culture. And what the Sfas Emes points out so beautifully is a world where nature is the focus is a world that fades, because everything in nature erodes. It dies eventually. It fades away. There isn't anything that's a part of nature that is eternal. There isn't. Everything has a clock, an expiration date. And what the Greek culture stood for, while they stood for beauty and philosophy and the intellect, what they didn't, or what they may not have realized, but what they also stood for was fading away, dying. And the opposite of that is what the Jewish people stood for, which is constant renewal, constant ability to go beyond the norm, to go beyond the natural. And that's really what Judaism is. You will be extra special. You will be the exception to the rule. Every other culture, every other nation throughout history will die off, because that's what happens to nations, especially when they're exiled, especially when wars happen. Except you will go through war after war and exile after exile, and you will be the exception to the rule. You will not die. You will not fade. You will be like a candle that continuously burns, that doesn't ever burn out. Which, by the way, where do we see an example of an image of something that's burning but not being consumed? The first actual image of God in the Torah is something within nature that is supernatural. It's the weirdest thing in a million years, if I ever told you, what would you use as an image in nature for God? It's a thorn bush with fire, but if you look closely, you'll notice that the branches, they're not getting brown or black or anything, they're just staying right there. What? Right? But the idea behind that is exactly everything that God represents, which is living within nature and existing in a supernatural way. And that's really what we as the Jewish people are supposed to parallel, which is living within nature, living in a world where there are Greeks, but transcending that at the same time. That's why we are the Am HaNetzach, we are this eternal nation. And by the way, maybe that's why the halacha which we follow, which is Beis Hillel, for Mahadran Min Mahadran, is Mosif V'Holich. We don't fade away. We don't go down. We are Malin B'Kodesh V'Ein Moridin. We get bigger and better. The light grows stronger over time, which if you think about it, the natural tendency of lighting a candle, of lighting a flame, is that it consumes whatever fuel it is using and slowly fades. If you ever had a bonfire, slowly fades. And yet, what we do on Hanukkah is we start with this one little flame and it gets bigger and bigger and more lights and more lights. And then the last night of Hanukkah, when you're kind of all sufganiyad out, right, you're ready to eat more healthily, it's the most candles of the entire holiday. And that works perfectly with this idea where we're not just against oppression, spiritual oppression, we're against the idea that things get stale, that things get cold and kind of boring over time. We reinvigorate ourselves. We have this idea of renewal, of things could get stronger over time instead of weaker. That's the idea, says the Medrash, behind lightness and light and darkness. This theme of Hanukkah, it's at the darkest time of the year. It gets dark like at lunchtime. And the Medrash says in Bereishis, V'choshech zeh golos yavon. It's actually a Medrash in the beginning of Parshas Bereishis, or V'choshech. What is this choshech? It's the exile of Yavan, of Greece. Shehech shicha einehem shal Yisrael b'gzeir seyem shal hayisom ereslem kisru al keren ashur she'em lechem chelek b'elokei Yisrael. What did the Greeks do to the Jews? They darkened their eyes with their decrees, because they would tell them to write on the horn of an ox, we won't go into that, that they don't have a portion in their Jewish God. They were trying to pull away our religion from us, our specialness, what makes us unique and eternal. You're not connected to God. You're just like us. Natural. You're regular. You're not best of the best. You're not better than us. There are no levels of humanity where you rest on a Mahajan or a Mahajan and a Mahajan level of humanity, whereas we're just normal humans. No, no, no. Separate yourself from this God thing and live like us, because that's how it works. And what is the idea of darkness, of choshech? Think about darkness. Darkness is static, right? What? Cold and dark. That's what it is, winter. That's when we're lighting the Hanukkah candles. If it's dark, you're not really moving around a lot. What do people do at night? They sleep, generally, except for college, right? They sleep. They're not moving. If it's dark outside, can you walk around freely the way you do at nighttime? No, you're kind of moving very slowly or not at all. What was the plague of Choshech and Mitzrayim? It was so, the darkness was so thick that they couldn't move. You're static. You're immobile. What is Or? Or warms you up. It moves you around. Actual chemical breakdown of fire is energy. Energy is movement of cells. The more movement, the more heat, the more light there is. It's movement. It's growth. It's expansion. That's the idea of spirituality, that there's this room to become much bigger than what you already are, whereas if you focus on nature as the be-all and end-all, then what you find is every day gets a little colder and darker than the day before it. The Sifsei Chaim, I'm not going to read inside. Rav Chaim Friedlander, he was the Mashkiach in Panovich, in Bnei Brak. Actually his Talmidim compiled a lot of his teachings, beautiful volumes of Svarim I read through many times, the Sifsei Chaim. He goes through a nice explanation of this war between Greece, the Greeks, and the Jewish people. And he basically explains, along the lines of what we said, he explains more clearly that the war isn't between the natural and the supernatural, the Greeks being the natural and the Jews being supernatural. The Jewish people also need the natural. We live in nature. We're not living like monks on hilltops, transcending. We're not smoking weird things in order to get way past the world. No. We're trying to live, do mitzvot, do commandments in nature, which is why the Ten Commandments, half of them are just like, don't steal money from people. Right? That's not a transcendental, spiritual thing, but it's one of our Ten Commandments. Why? Because as a Jew, we live in nature and we perform spiritual acts within nature. So the argument isn't, we prefer supernatural and you prefer nature and we're going to fight against each other. We both want nature, but what is the goal of nature? The Greeks say the goal of nature is nature. It's beautiful, it's great, it tastes good, looks good, sounds good, it makes sense to me, it's logical, reason, it's poetic, it's beautiful, it is what it is and I love it. And the Jewish people see nature as, this is what we need in order to build upon it and get us to something beyond nature. It is we look at nature and we find this supernatural within it. Like I said, the sneh, the image of the sneh is I'm looking at something completely mundane and natural and I'm seeing with it something completely supernatural. Which, by the way, if you were here last week, the idea of Yaakov and Esav and how Yaakov takes on the identity of Esav, this is the same exact idea. It's Yaakov is this guy who is that monk who hides out and just learns, and he's spiritual and he has no connection to the world. And his destiny isn't to remain that way. His destiny is to join humanity and become someone who is involved, very involved, heavily involved in this world, and is attempting to elevate it and to use it towards spiritual means. We see this in the bracha that Noach gives his son, Yafes. Source number 9. He gives his son Yafes a bracha, Yafes being the father of the Greek nation, or the Greco-Roman people. Shem being our great-great-great-grandfather. Yaft Elokim le-Yefet, he should glorify or enlarge Yefet, God should. V'yishkon ba'alei Shem, and he should dwell in the tents of Shem. What does that mean, that Yefet should dwell in the tents of Shem? Hey, our tents are ours, he should live in his own tent. And isn't Greek culture bad? Doesn't this go against the whole idea of Hanukkah, how we're fighting against the Greeks? Well, the answer is no. There's a place for nature. There's a place for beauty. There's a place for reason and logic and poetry and all those things. But that place is as a platform to build on it, to use it to elevate our lives and make them more spiritually gratifying and more meaningful when we use it to go beyond nature. The idea of Mahadran min Mahadran, of saying, I'm not settling for normal because my existence is to look beyond the normal, is to do it the best way, because I know the whole point of doing it at all is to get the intended result. The intended result isn't that a candle should be lit in front of me. I could do that. I could light one candle each night and go and eat my dinner and go out or go to sleep or catch up on TV, and I lit my candle. But the goal is elevating my life to a place where it is supernatural, where it is connecting to something beyond this world. And the idea of fire, which is expansive, which is energy, which is moving, which is passion, which is taking away darkness. And by the way, if you think about it, darkness isn't a thing. Darkness is just the absence of light, a beautiful idea if you meditate on that a little. That the world is actually light, and all that darkness is when there's no light there. And Yavan is basically saying, if there's no meaning there, so then you're Yavan. If there's no energy, if there's no passion, if there's no movement, if there's just a candle here, so then it's probably going to be mostly dark and very little light. But if you light more and it gets lighter and lighter, so then you're connecting to something. You're starting to get the point. And that's why the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama say, if you're doing it less than this, then why are you doing it? This is just a rabbinic law. This is not like God says you have to do it this way. This is the rabbi saying there's a point to this. There's an idea. You're supposed to dig deep in the middle of the winter when you wake up and the sun's going down and you say, I need to get myself moving. I need to get myself connected. I need to be elevated. I need to remind myself that it's not just the routine 9 to 5, do homework, go home, talk to friends, text, whatever, and just leave. There's something special to my life. And maybe winter, maybe the idea of choshech is the easiest way of distracting us from that idea of just cold, dark, by myself, just too lazy or can't get out of bed or can't move around too much. There's a famous song written by a man named John Lennon called Imagine. People love it. People love this song. Now, people, I think, not only love the... Good, I'm going to explain how I kind of agree with you. Now, the music is beautiful, but what I think people really love about the song is the message. I think whatever you hear, I don't know, you could YouTube it when you're not doing something spiritual and meaningful and you need a break or something. Briefly. That people just like get to, it's just like world, everyone get together. And it's a beautiful thing. And no one, everyone's equal and everyone tolerates and everyone's beautiful. And it's so politically correct, it's insane how politically correct it is. Right? And it's just great. There's no heaven, there's no hell. I mean, I could go through it. How many of you have never heard of this song before? Or even its existence? You know what? Don't raise your hand. It might be embarrassing. You might think it's embarrassing. Okay. It's a famous song. It's a band that's pretty famous called the Beatles. And it basically says, imagine if there were, in a nutshell, imagine if there were no boundaries. There was no one better or worse than anyone else. There's nothing real to fight for. There was no where you're going after this world. There's no heaven or hell. Right? I hope someday you'll join us and the whole world will live as one. And it's so beautiful, world peace. It sounds like the ideal of the world, except it leaves out one thing. It reduces the world to a completely meaningless, nothing to strive for, no reason why I exist instead of you, and we can all exist and not have problems with each other, except I might not want to wake up tomorrow, because why am I here? What am I doing? There's nowhere I'm going after this world. There's nothing I believe in this world, because I can't believe in anything different than you. And as long as whatever we believe in is the same thing, doesn't matter if it's true or false or real or not, then everything's good. And this beautiful idea, which I really do think, and I'm going to be politically incorrect about it, is basically Western culture in a nutshell at this point, where you can't be different. You're not allowed to. Or if you are different, then you have to accept how everyone's different. And if you're different than all the other different people, then that's a problem. I don't know if that made sense, but you know what I mean. And it's this problem that takes away from our passion as Jewish people. It's this ideology where I'm not allowed to be too different. My favorite example is if I'm ever in an airport, more for guys than girls, and I have to put on tefillin before I get on a plane. I'm not talking about El Al flights where most of the plane is down. I'm talking about, like, I'm on a plane to Tallahassee, and I'm in the airport, and I know that this is the best time for me to put on tefillin and daven, and everyone around me is not like me, right? And I have to just go for it and find the only private place in the whole airport, except there isn't one, unless it's a bathroom. And I feel so strange and weird. And maybe it's because we don't own it. We're not like, this is what makes me special. This is what makes me different. And I'm passionate about it, and why would I ever think that I shouldn't be part of it? Now, I'm generalizing here, and I'm making a kind of a simple statement of a very complicated idea. But the idea is there. It's funny, there's a magazine that just came out, actually yesterday, called Jewish Action. It's a magazine that's put out a few times every year by the OU in America. I actually have a couple friends now, this is how old I am, that are editors of this magazine that I went to yeshiva and school with and helped write an article about Neo-Hasidus, this movement. Now, it's funny because they're talking about it as if it's like 5 years old, but it really started like a few hundred years ago. But the truth is Hasidus started a few hundred years ago. Neo-Hasidus started like 50, 60 years ago. But there's a movement now where people get from regular Orthodox or even less affiliated homes, and they don't just become religious, but they become Hasidic. But not that they go live across the bridge, but they go live in a normal world, but their hair might be longer or different, and the way they daven, or the length that they daven, or the length or the style of their dress or tzitzis, and everything is just kind of more Hasidic. I don't know how to say it any differently. A lot of these people are my friends, by the way. and it talks about, well, how this happened, why this happened. And actually it quoted in the article is a friend of mine, a very special holy Jew. I have a privilege to be friendly with Rav Moshe Tzvi Weinberg, who quoted a story in this article. He said the a misnagid, a very Litvisha Jew, someone who was very not Hasidic, approached the Tzemach Tzedek, who was the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was also named Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, but he wasn't the one that we're familiar with. He was a few generations earlier. And he said, what's the difference between you and me? We do the same mitzvos, we fear the same God. What's the difference? And the Tzemach Tzedek said, I'll tell you the difference. We're both chicken soups. We both have exactly the same ingredients, the exact same pot. Except one of them is hot, one of them is cold. That's what he said. And the idea being, Judaism isn't just throw a lulav in there and throw a shofar and throw some davening and throw some matzah and you got Judaism. Perfect. Just do those things and then it works. Trust me. You get really holy and you get all these points and you get reward and it's great. Now, there is an aspect of it that is like that because there is such a thing called minimum requirements. But Hanukkah is teaching us that if you're looking to make a chicken soup, you got to put some fire under it. Or else it's just going to take like cold carrots and chicken in water. That's the point. The point isn't to put everything in a pot. The point is to make something special here. And Hanukkah is saying, if you don't have it on fire, then you don't have it at all. Don't consider the minimum requirement. That's not the point. Don't consider it. It's not one of the options here, says the Shulchan Aruch. Hopefully, it's still a few weeks away, but that's a very good thing because it means we have time to prepare. Because often we get there and it's already the first night and we're like, oh God, well, what are we doing? And that's the idea of preparing in advance for spirituality, for spiritual experiences. Hopefully we'll take this idea to heart. The coldest, every other day, the coldest, the weather here is crazy, the coldest and darkest time of the year, and remember that there's something very unique and special and passionate about what we do, about who we are, and it doesn't exist in the same framework that the rest of our lives exist, that the rest of other people's lives exist. It's totally beyond that. And all we need to do is listen close enough and get back to basics a bit and remind ourselves that we are connected to something eternal, something infinite, something supernatural. And hopefully, in turn, Hanukkah will light the flames in ourselves and help it continue throughout the year, throughout our lives. V'chein yi ratzon. Hopefully that will be. All right, thank you.